here are really a perfect segue into our topic this morning, which is broadly about emuna and bitachon, faith in Hashem versus personal initiative, hishtadlus. But it is framed around an interesting historical footnote regarding the Great Seal of the United States of America. So I'm going to share my screen with you in a moment. But the Great Seal of the United States of America, I think many of us are familiar with. You probably have seen it either, the beginning of a presidential address on TV, or in other situations. However, there's an obverse and there's a reverse. There's the front and the back of the seal. And I think while most of us are familiar with the front of the seal, which is usually presented at events, I think probably less well known is the reverse of the seal. Furthermore, the seal that we have today is not, was not a submission that was just, created, developed, and approved. There was a whole process by which this seal came about. So I'm going to share my screen with you in just a second here. Let's see. Host disabled participant screen sharing. Okay, Rabbi Schiffman, are you still there?
Yeah, you're on. Go. I just made two calls.
Okay, let's try that again. All right. Okay, so I'm going to share my screen with you. And, okay. Let's see. There we go. Okay, this is the... I guess a little bit of a animated. This is not exactly what we're familiar with. This looks more like a cartoon drawing, but this is basically it. It's the eagle with the flag and holding in both of its claws 13 arrows and a olive branch with 13 leaves representing war and peace and strength and the 13 colonies and the E pluribus unum, out of many one. All right, so this is, I think, what we are familiar with. However, the back of the seal is this, right, which is an unfinished pyramid. In other words, a work in progress. And then we have on top of it the divine eye of providence. The divine eye of providence. Then it says, and I'm not a fluent in Latin, septus or coeptus, which means God approving of our undertaking. And then on the bottom, novus ordo seclorum, which is the new order of the ages. Okay, so it's really the back of the seal that I want to focus on in a moment. But let's go back a little bit in time, and just for a brief history or a brief summary, better than a history, of the development of the seal. So I unshared our screen for a moment. I will get back to it in just a minute. And let's see, where are we? Okay. July 4th, 1776, the same day that independence was declared from Great Britain, the Continental Congress named a committee to design the Great Seal, the national emblem for the United States, what would be the United States of America. And somebody once said to me, what is the definition of a committee? A committee is a group of people who are assembled in order to appoint a committee. So committee is a funny kind of thing. We don't really know what committees do. But on this committee, there were three out of the five drafters of the Declaration of Independence, including Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. So they were members of this first committee. And wouldn't you know it, that the first committee was not the last committee. It took several years, 6 years from 1776 until 1782, two more committees until we finally get to the seal of the United States of America as we know it. So initially, in this committee of Adams, Jefferson, and Franklin, so there were various views as to what would be the appropriate draft. Now, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik has a very fascinating book. Let's see if I have it right in front of me. Yeah, a fascinating book. It's called "Proclaim Liberty Throughout the Land: The Hebrew Bible in the United States," and it is a source book, if you will, of various sources and their applications in the history of the United States of America and the impact of biblical sources and other Jewish sources on the development of life in America. And one source that he has here in his book is a letter from John Adams to his wife. And let me just see if I have that on the screen for you. Okay. There we go. Okay, I'm sharing my screen with you now. You should be able to see it in just a moment. And there we go. Okay, so you should see it. This is a letter from John Adams to his wife, Abigail. And here, he writes the following about the proposals for the Great Seal. "I am put upon a committee to prepare a device for a golden medal to commemorate the surrender of Boston to the American arms, and upon another to prepare devices for a great seal for the Confederated States." Not the Confederacy, right? The Confederation of the United States of America. Confederacy was a little bit later. "Dr. F," meaning Benjamin Franklin, "proposes a device for a seal. Moses lifting up his wand and dividing the Red Sea. And Pharaoh in his chariot overwhelmed with the waters." With an additional motto, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." So Franklin, his proposal was basically a vision of the Jews crossing the Red Sea, or the Reed Sea, and more specifically, Paro being overwhelmed in the waters. In other words, God's providence being powerfully demonstrated. Jefferson proposed, John Adams' letter continues, Mr. Jefferson proposed, "the children of Israel in the wilderness, led by a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, and on the other side, Hengist and Horsa, the Saxon chiefs from whom we claim the honor of being descended, and whose political principles and form of government we have assumed." I know very little, if nothing, about Hengist and Horsa, the Saxon chiefs, but I know a little bit about the children of Israel in the wilderness. And so both Jefferson and Franklin, three out of the five members of the committee, proposed scenes that go specifically to the Jews emerging from bondage in Egypt. However, two different scenes. One is the people being led by God, by the pillar of fire and the cloud, the Anan and the Amud HaEsh, and the other, Franklin's, Paro being overwhelmed in the sea. And I say that this is why Rabbi Schiffman's introduction, or his teaching while I was a little late, was actually a great segue. Because this is exactly what was proposed by the first committee, was to draw on Yetzias Mitzrayim, the 10, maybe not the 10 plagues, maybe not the 10 miracles, but at least one of them, which is Kriyas Yamsuf and the Jews going into the desert. Now, Meir Soloveitchik himself has his own interpretation. And so I have this, and this is what you have on your screen right now. So in Rabbi Soloveitchik's introduction to this little letter, he writes, after the Declaration of Independence was adopted, a committee was formed, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Adams had his own suggestion, and his suggestion was a scene from Roman mythology. Actually, if we just scroll back down, we could just see quickly. He writes, I propose the choice of Hercules as engraved by Gribelin in some editions of Shaftesbury's works, the hero resting on his club, virtue pointing to a rugged mountain on the one hand, persuading him to ascend, sloth glancing at her flowery paths, wantonly reclining on the ground, displaying the charms of eloquence in person to seduce him into vice. Which, even though this comes from Roman mythology, I think it's actually a very beautiful thing to have on the seal, to propose for the seal of the United States. The idea of choice, of bechira chafshis, that we're constantly in a state of choice in good over evil, of virtue versus vice. Nevertheless, I will leave Roman mythology aside and focus on Franklin and Jefferson. So Soloveitchik writes the following. He says, Jefferson and Franklin's suggestions reflect two different aspects of covenantal history. Franklin emphasized the miraculous and the providential, while Jefferson stressed the covenantal loyalty of people to their God and their mission. In other words, that Franklin emphasized God's providence, and Jefferson was focusing on the loyalty of the people. Now, I agree with this in part, but I look at these proposals from a slightly different perspective. And I think that the perspectives of Franklin and Jefferson, what each one proposes for the seal, is not so much loyalty versus miraculous providence, but I would say it's Hishtadlus versus bitachon. In other words, Franklin emphasized God's providence, our reliance on Hashem, right? If you look at from a Jewish perspective, the whole notion of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of Kriyas Yamsuf in particular, and Paro being overwhelmed by the seas, is all about Yad Hashem. If you look at the biblical verses, that's what it's about. Hashem is demonstrating His presence in the world, and we are entirely reliant on that. The Jews at the Reed Sea, at the Yam Suf, were entirely in God's hands. And the Paro being overwhelmed in the sea is entirely an act of God. In other words, our salvation in Yetzias Mitzrayim was a manifestation entirely of reliance on Hashem. We did not cause the waters to split. We did not cause the waters to come back. In fact, according to one Medrash, this was all set from before the world was created. The splitting of the sea was a miracle that was worked into creation that God established in the moments just before the close of the sixth day of creation. And I'm going to put us on hold here for just one moment. Esther?
Yeah.
The doorbell rang. Okay. So I think these two views actually suggest two different notions of what the relationship between man and God is. And this is what Franklin and Jefferson each wanted on the Great Seal. Now, this is a rendition of the seal in 1856, which apparently includes both, because here you see on the bottom half, here's supposedly Moshe Rabbeinu with his hands held high. And over here, where I'm putting my cursor and circulating, this is Paro, right, with his sword held high on a chariot. And, the waters are beginning to overtake them. So here you have on the bottom half, you have Franklin's proposal. And on the top, you have Jefferson's proposal, which is which is the, you know, the people of Israel, the Israelites, Bnei Israel, over here. And here you have the fire and the pillar of fire and the cloud leading the people. So this seems to be an amalgamation of both proposals. Having said that, neither of these proposals were in fact accepted. This committee of three invited a fellow who himself was an artist of sort, who had some experience in creating seals and flags and so on, and his name was Pierre Eugène du Simitière, and he was a consultant for the committee. The Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin submitted their proposals to him, and he put something together. And his draft proposal looks something like this, which has a shield. It includes, and has on the top over here this eye of divine providence. Now, the shield and the E Pluribus Unum, I don't think directly come, which are ultimately retained in our seal on the reverse of the seal, which we have today. But I think that these two elements of it in part derive forth from Franklin and Jefferson's proposals. Clearly, the divine eye of providence, Ayin Roa, Ozen Shomas, Pirkei Avos teaches us, Rabbi Schiffman, I'm sure, went through it already. If he didn't get up to that, if he didn't spend much time on it, I don't know. But Ayin Roa Ozen Shomas, a watchful eye. This derives forth not only from Amari Chazal, the watchful eye, but I think that Du Simitière was likely impacted by the proposals that were put in front of him. And two out of the three proposals that were put in front of him by Franklin and Adams were all about the God's providence and our relationship with God. And this gets retained in the final version. Then you have the E Pluribus Unum out of many one, which although is not directly or expressly stated by either Jefferson or Franklin, at least I think on some background level, that's clearly what is happening with the Jewish people emerging out of Egypt. Out of many, they become one. They, you know, they're a ragtag group, and they emerge as one nation under God, in fact. All right. However, we can leave the E Pluribus Unum aside for a second, and we'll just focus on the divine eye. So, but regardless of which, whether it was Jefferson or Franklin or Du Simitière's rendition as he understood it, it was all rejected. And in March of 1780, Congress turned the design and final report of the first committee over to a new committee composed of James Lovell, John Morris Scott, William Churchill Houston. And they asked Francis Hopkins, who had designed the American flag, to consult on it. And so Hopkins and the second committee contribute the flag, which ultimately is retained in the final seal. They also have a front and a back. We have the 13 pointed stars, but the second committee in 1780 was rejected as well. And Kedarkam by Bakodesh, as it is the way of our great United States Congress, in May of 1782, the Congress appointed yet a third committee. And the three members of this committee were John Rutledge, Arthur Middleton, and Elias Boudinot, and they were the members of this committee. They did no work on it themselves. They relied on the services of a fellow by the name of William Barton, who really brought it about, the proposal for this committee. Now I said that we're going to talk about the Jewish impact or influence on the Great Seal, and uh, the Jewish influence is not so much any particular Jew, but it is the Jewish influence. Jewish meaning the influence of the Judeo heritage of the Bible, of Tanakh, of the story of the Jewish people. And despite what some may think, this fellow, William Barton of Philadelphia, had nothing to do with Barton's chocolates or candies for Pesach, an entirely different Barton. And nevertheless, with his contributions, and we get his contributions retain some of the original. He adds his own, but at the end of the day, this is rejected as well. On June 13th, his chief contribution was the eagle, and he combined it with a small flag, and the 13-step unfinished pyramid. But he does retain that divine eye of providence, which I think harkens back to Jefferson and Franklin's Yitzias Mitzrayim theme. Okay. June 13th, 1782, one more time, the Congress are still not satisfied, and they present the recommendation of the various committees to Charles Thompson, who was the Secretary of the Congress. He selected what he thought were the best features of the of the various proposals, and in the end, we get basically what is a drawing, but you basically have what we have today, which includes both the front and the back, the obverse and the reverse, and the seal of the great seal of the United States of America, as we know it today. And what I think is important for us, again, is not the front, or even the E Pluribus Unum, which I think is worthy of investigation, but even more so, the reverse. Where did my reverse go? Where is the reverse? There we go. Is the reverse, with the divine eye of providence. So the divine eye of providence doesn't tell us which view of the relationship between man and God is being proposed here, is being propelled here on our seal. Is it Jefferson's view? Is it Franklin's view? And what is the Jewish view between the notion of reliance on God entirely, that is Yitzias Mitzrayim, the Paro at the sea, being overwhelmed by the sea? There is no human intervention that is entirely God. Or is it the Jewish people making a willful choice to follow God in the desert? So is it Hishtadlus? Is it our agency? Is it human agency? Or is it simply bitachon, simply relying on God? So I want to take a few minutes to think about, and it's not clear, right? All we have here is an eye, which is the divine eye of providence. Ayin ro'av ozan shomas. So I want to take I want to walk us down a path for a few moments and look at the question of reliance on God, divine and bitachon, versus hishtadlus, human agency and human initiative and personal initiative, in a few different contexts in life and as we find in the sources. So let me. We'll start with, get rid of this for a second. Let us begin with a simple question. It may be the most simple, and it may be the most limited, but it's a good place to start. And that is, when we talk about reliance on God versus human agency and personal initiative, one place to start is really thinking about, putting food in our mouths. How do we support ourselves? Do we come from a perspective, HaKol Bidei Shamayim, everything is in God's hands, and therefore I can sit back on my porch and whatever sustenance is due, I will get, and whatever sustenance is not due to me, I will not get. Or do we look at it, do we have a perspective of Ishtadlis, that we have to make it happen? So I will start with a discussion of this from Michovas Halvavos. And Chovas Halvavos, this is an English rendition of the Chovas Halvavos. And on the very limited question of human agency versus reliance on the divine when it comes to supporting ourselves, Chovas Halvavos writes the following. Again, this is a English translation. When we examine the need for a man to pursue means and exert himself to complete his needs, we can see with our own eyes that for one who needs food and proper food is served before him, if he does not exert himself to eat it by lifting the food to his mouth, chewing it, etc., he will not break his hunger. Likewise, for someone who is thirsty, who needs water, and all the more so, if he has no food prepared, until he needs to exert himself through milling flour, kneading, baking, etc. And more so, if he needs to buy the food and prepare it. And even more so still, if he has no money to buy them, and he will need even greater exertion to pursue means to earn the money or to sell the amount he needs for the object he uses or his other possessions or the like. In other words, Chovas Halavos is saying, on a most basic level, we cannot say complete reliance on God. In the most limited way possible, in the most minimal way possible, we have to say that there's personal initiative. Because even if God puts the food on our plate, we still have to take our hand and put it in our mouth, right? We still have to take the cup of water and raise it to our lips to quench our thirst. So on the most basic level, there requires some level of personal and human initiative, right? So now take that on a broader level when it comes to personal sustenance. And he says, of course, that if you don't have the food, you have to go out and get it, and if you can't and mill it and grind it and make it, and if you can't do it yourself, then you have to purchase it, and all this requires requires personal human effort and exertion. So this is what we call hishtadlus. So Chovas Halvavos says, let's look at the reality of life. And the reality of life, when it comes to this very limited question of earning a livelihood, demands human agency, human involvement, human interaction, and human initiative. Why? Why? If we have the notion of relying on Hashem, bitachon and emuna, why? Why don't we take that to its fullness and put our money where our mouth is, and say, I rely on God. Once I go out to the workplace, am I not in implicitly denying God's providence and God's or God's ability or God's interest in making it happen for me? So why must a man work? So Chovas Halvavos has a very fascinating two-pronged approach. Why it is that we should go to work and try to earn a living to support ourselves. And it has, I think, a positive and a negative spin to it. It says two things. There are two reasons why the Creator obligated a man to pursue means and exert himself. One, divine wisdom required the testing of man in the service of God or rebellion against him, and therefore God tests man with what demonstrates his choice in this. In other words, the reason that God requires of us to go to work and to do something in order to bring in our sustenance is not because the Protestant work ethic, it's good to work, right? Not because there is a value in getting out there and being a partner in the creation. No, it's simply that life is a test of morals and virtue and character. And therefore, God provides us this scenario that we have to go out and work to sustain ourselves in order to demonstrate our moral character, to test us, to give us opportunities to make choices. And if we, you know, if we cheat on our taxes, or we cheat in business, or we cheat in a in our professional life. A person came to me a few years ago and told me that he had been going to a health professional for many years, and it turned out that he found out, just, you know, through going through it to another health professional for another reason, that the first health professional had totally mismanaged his responsibilities, and the guy was in a terrible health situation as a result of the mismanagement. So, you know, there are ways that a person can go out and work, and in an honorable way. And the purpose of work, says Chovas Halvavos, again, is not because there's value in work. It's in order to give us, to provide us the test, to demonstrate our moral character, and to give us the choices that we can deepen and make and create a profound moral life of existence. Which is a pretty, on the one hand, it's a powerful thought. On the other hand, it really totally denigrates or dismisses any value in human agency. It's really, from the Chovas HaVavos perspective over here, just there for the purposes of giving you a test. But if you didn't need the test, let's say you were a morally perfect person, you had reached a level of perfection, then you wouldn't need to work. Secondly, he says, if a man were not forced to exert himself in seeking a livelihood, he would kick and chase after sin, vayishman yishur and vayivat, and he would ignore his debt of gratitude to God for his goodness to him. In other words, to borrow from another faith tradition, idle hands are the work of the devil. You have to go out to work, because if we didn't have to work, then people would sit around and ploiter about and end up doing, you know, all types of sinful behavior. So in order to prevent that, you know, we have to go out and work. So Chovas HaLevavos really has a very minimal view in this limited perspective of the notion of human agency versus divine, versus reliance on the divine. It seems that the Chovas HaLevavos falls on the side of reliance on the divine. And when it comes to sustaining ourselves and bringing in our personal sustenance, it is simply there for some for some extraneous reason, i.e., either to test our moral character, or b, to make sure that we don't go around using our idle hands for sin. But this puts very little value on human effort. And so this is one framework to think about it. And from this perspective, you know, if we go back to Jefferson and Franklin, the Jews in the desert versus God versus Paro being wiped out in the sea, it would seem that the divine eye should be the divine eye of Franklin, not Jefferson. Entire reliance on God. Okay. However, let's look a little further here, and I have to unshare my screen for a second. Okay, I want to share with you a famous debate regarding this question of emunah bitachon versus hishtadlus. Is the story of, I'm resharing my screen with you now, is the story of Yosef. This is a very famous debate regarding Yosef Hatzadik. Okay, you should have it on your screen now. So the story of Yosef is quite, we all know the story of Yosef. The Torah tells us that when Yosef when the Saramashkim was freed, he went to the Yosef told him, by the way, when you speak to Paro, please remember me to Paro and make sure that, you know, help me get out of prison. And the Medrash says that this was a tremendous act of lack of faith and trust in God on Yosef's part, because of the fact that he seemed to put his faith in the Saramashkim rather than putting his faith in God. And because of this, he was jailed for another 2 years before Paro let him, before he was let out. He had two extra years of imprisonment because of the fact that he said to to the Sar Hamashkim im zachor zchartani v'hizkartani v'hizkarti. In other words, please remember me to Paro for saying that, for putting his faith in the Sar Hamashkim and in human agency. He got another 2 years of prison time. That's what the Medrash says. And many of the rabbis have wondered to try to understand this Medrash, because it flies in the face of, although we have the notion of reliance on God, we have not just a picture of the Jewish people following God in the desert, human initiative, but we have actually a pasuk in the Torah, which says, on this fourth line over here where my cursor is, V'asafta diganech, whoops, V'asafta diganecha, You shall collect all of your produce. In other words, if you want to eat, you have to collect the produce. In an agrarian society, people don't eat if they don't till the land. So how do you square these two? Why should Yosef HaTzadik have been punished for asking the Sar Hamashkim to put in a good word to Paro? So this is a question that many have asked, and there's a great debate here as it relates to our particular question of bitachon versus hishtadlus, relying on God versus human personal initiative. So the Beis Halevi says the following: Ikar ha'inyan, I bolded it for you in bold letters here. Ikar ha'inyan yesh lomar dezehu klal. This is the rule for every Jew. She yehalibo shoketu boteach b'Hashem. A person should always rely on God. The fact that the Torah permits human initiative, our personal initiative, and it is not considered a slap in the face towards God, the Torah permits, doesn't suggest, doesn't urge us. But the Torah permits human initiative, says the Beis Halevi. Mishum delo kol adam yachol lahagia lemadregas habitachon hagamur. Not everybody can have perfect faith. V'alkein, and therefore, hutar lo hishtadlus kidei shehiya lo siyua shehagia lemadregas haboteach. God permitted us human action, so that way we are given the opportunity through our daily life, to try to. To climb the ladder of faith and trust in Hashem. But really, somebody who had complete faith and trust in God, not everybody can do that, but somebody who has complete faith, human agency is prohibited, says the Beis Halevi. And this is similar. He says, V'tzarech kol adam l'chadesh l'malacha v'esek k'dei sh'yelo nakel l'ftoach b'Hashem. And therefore, the more that a person has emunah and bitachon in Hashem, the less the person should be doing human initiative. The imkain, and therefore, skipping to the next bold faced here, the imkain, shir ha'ishtadlus hanirza, how much personal initiative should you do? Eino shave b'chol adam, it's not equal for every person. Kol echad l'fi yarko, everybody according to their capability. Somebody who is a high level believer, somebody who has a great level of faith in God, should work very little. The more he works, the more it is a demonstration of lack of faith. Somebody who has little faith has greater latitude. So the amount of work that we should be doing, the amount of initiative that we should be taking, is commensurate to the amount of faith that we have, says the Beis Halevi. And therefore, Yosef HaTzadik, who was on a very high level of faith, understood that everything comes from God on the most visceral way. He should not have put himself in Paro's hands. He should have just prayed to God and put himself in God's hands by asking the Sar Hamashkim to put in a good word for him to Paro. On his level of righteousness, was considered an act of a lack of faith. So, from the Beis Halevi's perspective, therefore, it's a sliding scale. And really, ideally, if a person could perfect themselves, they should really take no initiative in life. Because everything comes from God. Hakol bidei shamayim. Everything comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Right, that's the Beis Halevi's approach. But by the way, the Beis Halevi's approach is a good approach if a person really, truly is perfect in his or her faith in God. But you know, sometimes you meet people that say, you know, they believe in God, and everything comes from Hashem, and therefore they don't work or they don't do it, or they don't try to put any initiative to better whatever their sorry lot is in life because they believe in Hashem, but then they're complaining about it all the time. So if a person is complaining about it all the time, it doesn't really mean it indicates that they're not really on that level. So if they're not on that level, then their lack of initiative is just sloth and laziness. It's not truly a reflection of faith. The level of personal initiative in life should be commensurate with a person's level of faith, and this gives us an opportunity to grow and go up that ladder. So this is the Beis Halevi's approach. The Chazon Ish had a very different approach. This is a well-known debate between the Beis Halevi and the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish, and I don't think I have it in front of you. Let's see if one second. Here it is. Okay. The Chazon Ish wrote the following. In his book, Emuna, Ubitachon, Faith and Belief, Belief and Faith. There we go. So the Chazon Ish says the following. He takes issue with the approach. He says, no, there is good reason for a person to involve themselves with human initiative. That is normal living. That is normal life. And people should work and people should do. And if a person, if a person has some challenge in their life, like Yosef HaTzadik trying to get out of prison, it is appropriate to do whatever you can in order to increase your lot in life. Right? Why if you can call the governor and get your sentence commuted, call the governor. Right? It's right. Everybody knows the famous joke that a person is stuck on an island or out at sea, and he prays to God and says, you know, please help me. And a boat comes, says, no, I'm waiting. God is going to save me. And then a helicopter comes, God is going to save me. Coast Guard, God is going to save me. And the person drowns. And then ultimately, standing before the Kisei HaKavod on his day of judgment, he says, God, I had faith in you. What happened? He says, what do you mean? I sent you the boat, I sent you the helicopter, I sent you the Coast Guard. Right? So that joke reflects a truism according to the way the Chazon Ish looks at the balance between personal initiative and faith. And he says that sometimes there are some limitations relating to the efforts that one is allowed to make. A person should make normal, take normal initiative to better his lot in life. So if that is the case, what's the problem with Yosef? So he writes the following. He says, human beings are obligated to act and not to depend on miracles. Yosef obligated himself to make use of the opportunity and to enlist the help of the chief butler. But it is not the nature of people of that rank to remember and to do favors. And therefore, this act of Yosef was not appropriate, since it was an act of desperation. This was rak mitoch yeush. So what does the Chazon Ish say? Chazon Ish says, when is it personal initiative appropriate? And when is personal initiative a testament to a lack of faith and reliance on God? He says, well, it depends on the situation, right? In Yosef's case, if Yosef had a direct line to Paro and he could pick up the phone and ask Paro to commute his sentence, that would be appropriate. But to ask the janitor to put in a good word to Paro That's totally inappropriate. It is not logical that that would lead to the desired result. Because the butler, the guy who served Paro's wine, because he asked Paro to let Yosef out, Paro's gonna let him out. It's not a logical, normal. It is an act of desperation, and when a person acts out of desperation, that's where bitachon versus emuna comes into play. That's where the conflict comes into play. Where a person should say, no, I believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. I will do whatever I can. I will take the medicines that I can. I will see the doctors that I can. I will apply for the job opportunities I can. Right? But I'm not going to ask the FedEx delivery guy to see if I can interview for the position of CEO. It's just not. And if I'm truly putting my faith in that, and I think that that really is a possible way for me to get the job of CEO of FedEx, that is an act of desperation. It's just not logical, and it is not an appropriate expectation. And thus, Chazon Ish says that normal initiative is totally appropriate, as opposed to the Beis Halevi. But what is inappropriate is to act out of to despair, because a Jew cannot despair. A Jew has to rely and have bitachon on the Ribbono Shel Olam. So if we started out talking about, should you go to work or not, right? So this expands it a little bit more to the question of general initiative versus reliance on Hashem. Now, there is a well-known and if we take it back to our the Great Seal in the United States, so what were Jefferson, what were Jefferson and Franklin going for? Well, all we have is the divine eye. In other words, in a sense, Jefferson's view was rejected, and Franklin's view was rejected. In other words, the fellow who put together the committee's first proposal, took away both of them and replaced it with the divine eye of providence. So, is it Franklin's divine eye of providence that he was going for, or is it Jefferson's, or maybe it's both? Maybe it's Hishtadlus and Emuna. Maybe it's both the people at the Red Sea having absolutely nowhere to turn but Hashem, and the people in the desert having other places to turn but choosing to follow Hashem. So, I want to share with you a well-known statement in the Gemara. Let me just go back over here. The Gemara says, "Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz mira shamayim." Everything. Rabbi Chanina said, "Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz mira shamayim." Everything is in God's hands, in the hands of heaven, except for fear of heaven. And that's a well-known statement of the Gemara. However, there's another Gemara in Ksubas, which is the next source here on your page, which says, "Hakol bidei shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven, except for the cold and heat," meaning sickness that comes from cold and heat. In other words, everything is in God's hands. So in the first Gemara, the Gemara in Megillah seems to say, everything is in God's hands, except whether you sin or whether you do mitzvahs, except for fear of heaven. Your spiritual, moral standing in life, that is in your hands. The second Gemara in Kesubah says, everything is in God's hands, except for whether you get a cold or whether you get sick from the cold and heat, which is a much broader statement. So if the first Gemara says that your spiritual life is under your control and everything else is not, the second Gemara seems to say, everything is out of your control. The only thing that's in your control is whether you're going to get sick from the cold and heat, because So how do we understand what is the idea of these two Gemaras? So the Baalei Tosfos teach that that there are two parts of life, or there are two aspects of life, and that is, what are we born with? What are we endowed with? So when a person is born, with a certain endowment of strength, of wisdom, of all types of traits that we have. And even, Balei Tosfos say, whether a person is going to be rich or poor, all those things are really not in our hands. Those are in God's hands. What is in our hands? What is in our hands? So, what is in our hands is faith and spiritual matters. So, what the Gemaras here, taking them together, are saying the following. If the first Gemara is saying that spiritual matters are in your hand, and everything else is not, the second Gemara is saying that the events of life are not in our hands, but how we choose to deal with them is. Okay? So taking these Gemaras together, what is in our hands? What is in our hands is our spiritual life, the choices of good and bad, of mitzvah or sin. What is in our hands? How we manage the challenges that come our way. Those things are entirely within our hands. That's what it means to be a Jew. That's the balance of emunah versus hishtadlus. Hishtadlus means that whatever challenges God send my way, I am going to do my best to manage it. Hishtadlus means that I do my best to engage life's responsibilities, but I do it in a normal way. I don't act out of desperation. Hishtadlus means emuna, on the other hand, means that I know that I'm not in control of life's events. Emuna means that I know that as much as I try, that just like I can't change my eye color from brown to blue, although today a person can, I think, just like I can't change my eye color, just like I can't make myself 10 feet if I'm 6 feet, right? I also cannot ultimately control success and failure. I can do my hishtadlus, but ultimately success and failure is in God's hands. So at the end of the day, it seems that from some of the rabbinical sources and even just from an analysis of the Yosef story and the Chazal, we seem to have some that err on the side of personal responsibility, and more erring on the side of reliance on Hashem. So if we talked about sort of working for a living on a limited scale, dealing with the challenges of life on another scale, I want to leave us with one more frame of this picture. And that is the story of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is in chapter 3. In chapter 3, in the... Let's see, do we have it here? No, we do not have it here. In chapter 3 in Shmos... No, I didn't put it on the sheet for you. But in chapter 3 in Shmos, Moshe Rabbeinu is described with one word. And Moshe is described as... But you remember I'm not really giving you much to go on here. But Moshe Rabbeinu is described as an ish.
Ish Elohim.
Thank you. Who said
ish
that? Barbara. Thank you. All right. So he's described as an ish Elohim. So what does it mean to be an ish? To be an ish means to be a leader. I'm going to read you a few psukim that bears this out. Moshe Rabbeinu grows up, Vayar Ish Mitzri. He sees an Ish Mitzri, not just a Mitzri, but an Ish Mitzri. Maybe one of the overlords, one of the taskmasters, beating a Jew. Not ish, I'm sorry, ish mitzri, make ish ivri. So some type, not just a mitzri hitting an ivri, but an ish mitzri hitting an ish ivri. And he turns, vayifen kovacho, he looks in both directions, vayar ki ein ish. What does it mean, vayar ki ein ish? It means he saw nobody who was willing to get up and act and do and lead. Ish means a person that is willing to act and not just stand back and rely on something, you know, either somebody else or God or somebody is going to take care of it. That's an ish. And the person looks to Moshe and the next day, Vayetze Bayom Hasheni, the two people that are fighting, and Moshe castigates him, says, why are you hitting him? Vayomer, and he responds, Mi samcha, Barbara, you remember how that pasuk goes? Mi samcha? Nope, okay. Mi samcha, okay. Mi samcha li'i... What?
No.
Okay,
sure.
All right. I'll remind you. I have the pasuk in front of me, so it's easy. Mi samcha li'ish sar v'shofet. Who made you into the chief cook and bottle washer? Right? But sar and shofet would be sufficient. The pasuk says, mi samcha le'ish sar v'shofet. Ish means a person of action, a person of leadership. And Moshe realizes he has to run. So Moshe runs to Midian, and there he, of course, acts heroically on behalf of Tzipora and her sisters. And they run home, and they tell their father, Yisro, that they met a guy at the well who saved them. Vatomarna. And Yisro says, well, you know, why did you come home so early today? And they respond, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu. An Ish Mitzri. Not just a Mitzri. An Ish saved us. And Yisro tells his daughter, you saw an Ish at the well? Lama ze azavten es ha'ish. Why did you leave that man alone? Why did you leave him? It doesn't mean just a person. It means, why did you leave an ish? An ish is a person of high character, of standing, a leader, somebody who's willing to act and not just sit down and wait for things to happen. And in fact, he says to summon them, and they summon him, and Moshe comes, and he decides to join his lot with Yisro. Vayol Moshe Lasheves es ha'ish. Yisro was also a leader. Yisro was also a person of action. As we know, the next pasuk, Yisro was or the following pasukim, Yisro was a Kohen Midian. He wasn't just a schlepper. He was Kohen Midian. He was an ish. He was an ish. And this is who Hashem chooses to lead the Jewish people. He's an ish. Why did Hashem choose Moshe as an ish? He could have chosen anybody. If, in fact, Hakol Bidei Shamayim, everything is in God's hand, if, in fact, true faith is about putting all of our lot within God's hands and putting our hands under our behinds and sitting, anybody could have filled that position. Any good person. Maybe not anybody, but any good person. And maybe even somebody who was not an ish. Somebody who was not a person of action. Because that type of person would really demonstrate emunah and bitachon in Hashem. So why does Moshe Rabbeinu choose, why does Hashem choose Moshe Rabbeinu? Because Moshe Rabbeinu is an ish. Moshe Rabbeinu is a leader. Just like his father before him. At the very beginning of the Perek, we have Ayelech Ish Mibeis Levi. A man from the house of Levi came and did the unthinkable. He married. Where most people had given up, where most people had given into despair, his father, Amram, was an ish mibeis Levi. He did not give up. He did not despair. And he went and he got married. So Hashem chooses Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, who, me? I can't do it. I don't speak so well. People aren't going to believe me. He gives all types of excuses as to why it shouldn't be him. And you know what Hashem responds to Moshe Rabbeinu? After all is said and done, he says to him, stop it. Just stop it. He says, Mi sam pela adam. Pasuk Yud Aleph, chapter 4. Mi sam pela adam, o mi asu milem. Who do you think gives you the power of speech? It's you? You're so smart? You're so wise? You have such an extraordinarily talent? It's you? It's not you at all. Mi sam pela adam. It's me. I, Hashem, am the one who endowed you with these qualities. Which means that if you have these qualities, you are fully capable of executing. What we see from the story of Moshe Rabbeinu is in fact Hashem himself saying that we must take initiative, that we must be an ish or an isha, as the case may be, and take action. But that action must always be with the understanding, the knowledge, the wisdom, and the humility that everything comes from Hashem. It's a paradox, but it's a paradox that we have to live with in order to be able to live well and to live according to the mandate that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has set for us. Emuna and Hishtadlos. Faith and personal action. If we rely on our personal initiative, then that is a lack of faith. If we rely on Hashem without personal initiative, then that is an act of sloth, an act of laziness. We need both. HaKadosh Baruch Hu demands us. Maybe maybe for very utilitarian reasons, like Chovas Halvavos said, so we shouldn't get involved in sinful idol behavior. Or maybe it's something bigger than that. Maybe that is what is necessary. That is what is necessary to fully allow our personality as a believing Jew to flower. Because that is the model that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put before the Jewish people. That's what Hashem sent to Moshe. So is it personal responsibility and initiative and a human agency? Or is it reliance on the divine? Is it Hashem at the sea? Or is it the Jewish people following the cloud and the pillar of fire in the desert? I think the answer to this lies in one final thought that I heard in the name of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, who was the first, last, and only chief rabbi of New York. New York could not handle a chief rabbi. So we read not long ago two parshios that are right next to each other, the laws of Shemitah and the laws of Tzedakah, and the psukim regarding Tzedakah. So Rabbi Yaakov Yosef asked, "What ma inyan Shemitah etzal Tzedakah? What does Shemitah have to do with Tzedakah, that they're juxtaposed next to one another?" So he says, "You know what the deal is with Shemitah? 7 years you work, 6 years you work, 7 years the land lies fallow. And then you have to have a lot of emuna and faith in Hashem that the eighth year you're going to have food. Because the seventh year you're eating off the sixth year's produce. But the eighth year you have to rely on the seventh year. And the seventh year you weren't working. So you have to have a lot of emuna." And a person who succeeds in that is to be credited. Says Yaakov Yosef, if you find an ani, a poor person, crossing your path, so you have a choice. You say, look at me. I had faith in Hashem in the seventh year of Shemitah. You should also have faith in Hashem. Trust me. It works for me. It's going to work for you. Have faith. Rav Yaakov Yosef says that is a dangerous path to walk down. That a person can feel a great sense of pride that they succeeded in having faith and reliance on Hashem. But that's for you. When it comes to helping another Jew, when it comes to helping another person, we don't say, have emunah, have bitachon. That's 100% hishtadlus. You do what you can to help another person. When it comes to my own scenario, okay, then I have to weigh hishtadlus, emunah, at the sea, in the desert. I got to weigh those things. I have to see, what does God really want for me? How does Judaism see this balance? But when it comes to helping another person, there is no balance. It's all hishtadlus. in the sense that we cannot rely on, we cannot assume that the other person should just rely on God. I want to walk that back. It's not all hishtadlus. Even when you're helping another person, you do the best you can, but at the end of the day, you can only do the best you can, and you can't, you know, and you have to rely on Hashem, that hopefully Hashem is going to help. But this balance between emunah and hishtadlus is really only something for us that we have to think about and we have to work on in terms of our own life experience. But when it comes to looking at another, says Rav Yaakov Yosef, don't be so prideful and say, ah, I did Shemitah, you should also have emunah. No. When somebody else is in pain, when somebody else is suffering, my hishtadlus antenna has to go up. My personal initiative has to kick into place and at high speed. And perhaps to bring us back to the great seal of the United States of America, maybe it's al pi hashgacha that neither Franklin nor Jefferson's proposal was accepted. Maybe it's al pi hashgacha, you know, that the United States Congress limped into this fourth and final rendition of the great seal. But it did retain the essential ethos of Franklin and Jefferson, which is the divine eye of providence. And that divine eye of providence is relevant when it comes to the body politic, to the national experience of a country. Because what we are concerned about, especially as the founding fathers of the United States of America set up a separation between church and state, in which no church should be favored over another, but which all churches should infuse the public consciousness, that when it comes to the question of faith and trust in God, that's your personal domain. And you have to figure out that balance. But when it comes to the body politic, how we help each other, it's really all hishtadlus. It's really all about how can we take action to better our union, to make a more perfect union. And if you think about it, if you go back to the psukim that Jefferson, Franklin himself said that he wasn't looking at Paro being overwhelmed in the sea. In his own notes, he writes that Moses' hands, you know, held high as the divine ordinance of Paro's being overwhelmed in the sea. So even the picture of as he conceived of it, for the proposal for the Great Seal, really wasn't just about God's divine providence. Even though Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik says it's about divine providence and supernatural providence. I think no. I think that if you look at his own notes, at Franklin's own notes, it was Moshe holding his hands high. There is human agency. There is human initiative. Without the Jewish people stepping their foot in, without Moshe Rabbeinu raising his staff, there would be no splitting of the sea. Without our trying to help another, help is not necessarily coming. So when it comes to helping another, we have to have hishtadlus. But that hishtadlus must always be with the understanding that there is a divine eye of providence. There is an ayin roa. And within that context, if people are working mightily to help each other in the context of an ayin roa, then most certainly the notion of creating a more perfect union has a greater chance of being realized. So on this July 4th, when we think about the Great Seal of the United States of America, maybe there was no particular Jew who influenced the seal, but I think that the seal, in its essence, and in its most powerful message, is entirely a Jewish message coming forth from the Jewish texts and the Jewish sources from the Torah itself. And with that, I wish you all a happy July 4th weekend. And if anybody has any questions or comments, I'm happy to take them. Let's see. I see here some people wrote in the chat. Yes, the butler had the opportunity. Remember, there's divine providence. So why was his ishtadlus? The butler asked to remember Yosef. Okay. All right. Yeah, it is true that even in the story itself, Yosef does in fact mention Hashem. He's not totally devoid of Hashem, which is what makes the quote unquote punishment of Yosef's additional 2 years even more challenging. Right. Any questions or comments?
Yes, Rabbi.
Yeah, go ahead, Pola.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, God punished Adam and Eve, and he was supposed to work for his sustenance.
Yes, right. So that would be if you look at it from that perspective, that is in fact a punishment. Well, we're trying to, and according to what the Chovas Halvavos was saying, that a person who has perfect, a perfect faith would not have to work for their sustenance, because according to the Chovas Halvavos, the only reason for working is in order for a person to perfect their faith, because they don't. They shouldn't be idle. And in fact, maybe, I think that is the case. Yes, anybody else?
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi.
Go ahead, Barbara.
So what is the purpose, the reason behind the unfinished pyramid under the eye in the seal? Right. Where did they get the pyramid from? I mean,
I don't know. You'd have to. I don't know the answer to that. You'd have to read the notes set along with the proposal. Go ahead, Elaine. Go ahead.
Okay, as an art historian, all right. So when you take a look at the seal, I think you have to look at both sides the same, together. And so when you talked about hishtadlut is the initiative embedded in our free will. And if you look at the obverse, you see that you've got. The ego, again, this is based on the neoclassical period. So you've got looking at the political institutions of Greece and Rome. So you've got the ego, but you also have the arrows and you have the olive branch. It's man's will. You can fight or you can have peace. You have not the stars on the seal with the flag, but above it, because that's incomplete. And then on the reverse, when you're looking at the pyramid, it's incomplete. But all of this is man's action being done under divine providence. So I think that separation of church and state, which you brought up, Rabbi Tokea, that, it's whatever religion it is, there is some sort of divine providence looking over man's decisions, and man has his free will. He has to, take his action. He has to act on it, and whether he'll succeed or not, that's also the predetermination, but also the consequence of his actions.
Why the pyramid?
The pyramid is looking at the ancients who started something, but now you have to finish it. And that goes back to the discussion between Jefferson and Frank, like which aspect of that coming out of slavery into freedom is going to be stressed. But it's all under divine providence, and your work is not complete. Right. That's why it's not completed.
Right. I would also add that in the original three proposals between Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams, I would think that the front, the obverse of the seal reflects more Adams' view about choice, about making a choice, and the reverse retains the Jewish, the Franklin Jefferson aspect of it, of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and drawing on the divine aspect.
Right, and that's where the balance of the church and state actually is really apparent in the seal, like that whole balance that they were trying to build the new secular world, but under a divine and a Judeo-Christian tradition, because that's what they're coming from.
Right.
Which I agree.
Any other comments? Any other comments, questions? Okay.
Rabbi, can we get a copy of this plant? Is there a copy of it? It was excellent.
I have a recording of it.